Amador County Board of Supervisors meeting for Tuesday, April 9th, 2013 will come to order. The board has already met in closed session and looked at all of the items. There was no confidential minutes. And items 1, 2A, B, and 3, the board heard reports from staff. So with that, if you could all join me in the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. First item up is approval of the agenda. We do have an addendum, and the addendum's children, as Jennifer told me, addendas. So, the addendum is a consent agenda item with the surveying department approval of a resolution of intention to vacate portions of a public utility easement for Vernon R. Erickson Jr. and Ann Dethloff and scheduling a public hearing for same. The addenda, first item, is Amador Council of Tourism, discussion and possible action relative to a presentation by Ms. Maureen Funk, ACT Executive Director, relative to the proposed 2013 State Fair booth model and funding request for facilitation of construction of the same. We'll place that as item 9B on the agenda. And the second item is the California State Association of Counties, discussion and possible action relative to approval of the chairman's signature on a letter of opposition relative to sequestration of payments to states under the Secure Rural Schools Program. We'll place that on the agenda as item 11. Consent agenda item.
Chair, there is an item 11. So you want to go before that?
Oh, excuse me. Then we'll make it 10B. Okay. Thank you, Supervisor Plath. The consent agenda addendum. Make that.
Is that a resolution? Or?
Yes. Well, scheduling of a public hearing and approval of a resolution of intention. So I'll make that item 3D on the consent agenda. 3D. Okay, with that, any further discussion? Then can I have a motion to approve the consent agenda, or excuse me, the agenda?
I make a motion to approve the agenda.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Arnetto, second by Supervisor Plass to approve the agenda with the changes. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Vote is 401. Supervisor Boitano is out today. He had to make a trip to Idaho for a medical issue with a family member. Public matters not on the agenda. Discussion items only. No action to be taken. Any person may address the board at this time upon any subject within the jurisdiction of the Amador County Board of Supervisors. However, any matter that requires action may be referred to staff and our committee for a report and recommendation for possible action at a subsequent board meeting. There is a 3-minute time limit. Anyone like to address the board under public comment? Supervisors, anything? No? All right, thank you. Consent agenda with the one change.
Move approval of the consent agenda with the addition of item 3D.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Plass, second by Supervisor Novelli to approve the consent agenda with the addition of the surveying item. Any further discussion?
Item 3D or 3B?
3D.
D is in dog.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. We'll go into our regular agenda. Item, this should not be a long agenda today. Most of these items are legislation related. First item is Jackson Valley Rehabilitation Project, discussion of possible action relative to approval of the chairman's signature on a letter of recommendation to be sent to Caltrans District 10, encouraging construction of a westbound SR 88 left turn lane and Martin Lane as part of the subject project. I place this on the agenda and been in discussions with different members of the Caltrans team over the last 3 months. And ultimately what happened here is when the Jackson Valley Rehabilitation Project was designed, a traffic study was done at the intersection of Martin Lane and Highway 88 for the purposes of determining whether to put a left turn lane in there going westbound. That traffic study, as I understand it, I'm going to bring up Mr. Gedney in a second, but as I understand it, that traffic study showed there were not sufficient traffic warrants or deaths at that intersection at this time. So it was left out of the overall project. The neighbors in the area, the residents, are concerned, and I'm concerned because I had to pull off the road myself the other day to avoid the possibility of being rear-ended by traffic going east or westbound. This project is definitely a safety issue. Mr. Fields and I have talked via email on this. The ACTC consultant has looked at that intersection and identified it as a safety issue because of the concern that when you have traffic going westbound and there is no turn pocket there, if there's traffic, a sufficient amount of traffic going eastbound that doesn't allow you to turn, then you kind of take your life in your own hands sitting out there on the road and hoping that people will not rear-end you there. At this point, it doesn't appear that there's been enough warrants. But Caltrans has decided they cannot fund this project. There is funding in the budget, which Mr. Gedney will address, and they've done some projections on what it would cost to get it done. The problem is, the issue comes up of what I've seen so far is there doesn't appear to be an environmental issue, but there's a an issue with clearance, appropriate clearance from two PG&E poles that sit there, and it may require a design exception to be approved. With that, before I bring up Mr. Gedney, any other board members have any comments?
I'd just like to say I concur with you, Mr. Chairman. It is a very, very dangerous intersection. When I worked on the road crew out there, we were hoping that it would have gotten fixed many years ago, but I understand your concerns.
Yeah, I'd just like to state that that we've also got this on our upcoming ACTC agenda to try to see if we can in some way help Caltrans make a determination outside of their policy structure, I guess you would say, with the understanding that environmental is not an issue, that the preliminary analysis of this intersection showed that right-of-way was not an issue, and that funding is not an issue. I would just like to offer whatever encouragement or support or whatever it might take to help some of our state agencies sort of get out of their own way or the way of their own policies and get something done that's demonstrably needed, whether or not somebody's died there yet or not, and get a meaningful safety improvement done in budget and on time.
You know, along the same line, something I would look at is, I mean, they're worrying about the recovery zone. Somebody might hit a telephone pole. I think your chance of somebody getting rear-ended or broadsided or something else would probably, in my layperson opinion, is probably 10 times higher than somebody hitting that telephone pole because they didn't have enough recovery zone. That's why I would really like to see them put in that left turn lane. I think it would be very beneficial, make traffic a lot safer, and should be done.
Well, and I don't want Mr. Gedney to take all the heat on this. I mean, it's his job to be a representative up here, and I think they're trying to make this work now. It appears like Caltrans is hearing us, but I don't want to take out the whip on Mr. Gedney because just doing your job. So, if you could come up, John, and talk about this, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Gedney, Caltrans District 10. Let me just say, I think I agree with your assessment of the policy that we do find ourselves handcuffed, I think, too often by our procedures and our policies. But on the other hand, it does provide us our design immunity. Once we build a project, we do achieve design immunity for any potential lawsuits or any accidents that come down the road in the future. So I think on the one hand, we really value that process. But on the other hand, I know that we need to develop better working partnerships with our local agencies. And I think we're trying to do that. We recognize the need to do that and to become better at that.
Do you mind if we ask questions as you
Oh, please, along? Please.
Yeah. The design immunity, it's a big issue for Caltrans. I understand
right.
that. But what happens with the lack of design immunity if accidents happen there because knowing this is a safety issue, the project is not put into place?
Right. Again, that's where we are beholden to our policies, our SHOP program that implements safety improvements is based on the criteria of accident rates and histories and severity. And so then our SHOP coordinators in the district prioritize projects throughout the district.
For the layperson, spell out what SHOP is.
SHOP. Our SHOP program is our primary funding program to implement improvements for safety, rehabilitation, and operations on the state highway. These are not funds that go toward capacity improvement projects. They're mainly addressing current deficiencies. So our SHOP coordinators in the district review all the pavement and all the conditions in the district every year. Actually, every 3 years, they come up with a three-year program of projects that they will fund. And so it's essentially competitive based on all of the locations throughout the district that have perceived or actual problems with pavement operations or safety. It's the State Highway Operation Protection Program, the SHOP. Thank you.
Mr. Gidney, can I ask a follow-up on that? It's my understanding that this project, the whole Highway 88 corridor project, has been funded through that SHOP program, and that analysis of current remaining balances, if you will, of that funding level indicate that there's enough money left in this project to fund the left-hand turn lane of Martin Lane. Is that correct?
You know, I'm not sure of that yet. And in fact, I spoke with or emailed Dinah DeBortner, our deputy director for project management, this morning, and she asked our resident engineer for the project to check the contingency balance. I was hoping to get that answer for you this morning. to back up a little bit, we did do a preliminary layout of the turn lane project. I've got it here in case you'd like to take a look at it. It identifies the holes, and can't really see it, but I can give you a copy if you'd like to see it. The rough estimate for the pavement to put in the turn pocket estimated around $70,000, but as Chairman Forster was correctly noting, there is the power pole problem, and that really is the sticking point to incorporate this project in the larger rehab right now. It would require a mandatory design exception from headquarters. The district position currently is to not support requesting that design exception, again, going back to our design immunity protections. So if we try to come up with a plan going forward, I think the best option is to try to consider how we can move those poles. The $70,000 for the pavement and the turn pocket, I can't say for certain, but I would expect that it's within the contingency budget. The power poles, I'm not sure how much that would cost to move. Yes, sir.
That was my question. So.
Oh, okay.
Well, and I guess my point is going in the direction of, if the environmental is not an issue and budget is not an issue because that project has adequate contingency funds in it to do this change order, so to speak, then what level of design immunity does Caltrans have if they show that they've studied this alternative, they had the funding, they had the environmental clearances, they had the right-of-way, and they chose not to do it, and somebody gets hit or dies there? Is there a greater risk towards a lack of immunity for not having done something that indicated should have been done versus doing something that protects against something in the future not happening? You know,
that's a great question.
There's liability in all aspects.
But if they did nothing, they're not liable.
That's a good question. Well, and I think that gets to the Hippocratic Oath a little bit of, you know, if you don't do it, you know, if it's not fixed, don't. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, is kind of where we are there. As, again, getting back to the criteria that's established to fund these kind of safety projects, if it doesn't reach that threshold, and I think the email that Charles laid out for your ACTC agenda really accurately lays out the history of this discussion and indicates that our operations chief noted that it didn't reach that threshold. So I think that's where we're protect. That's where we achieve our protection on the immunity. If it doesn't reach the threshold, we don't do the project. Unfortunately, you know, we all know that, you know, it does take an accident really to hit the threshold. So it's the chicken or the egg, and it's an unfortunate situation. But that's how the department operates.
All right, go ahead, Ted.
Mr. Getty, sir, who determines whether? Once this project goes forward, or if it doesn't go forward, whether it's going to be a no left turn or not. I mean, who on Caltrans makes that determination?
A no left turn?
Yeah.
No, left turns are allowed at that location. There's just no protected pocket.
Right, but I'm asking who determines that?
Oh, that it's not a fundable project?
Right.
That's our shop coordinator would make that determination, or that recommendation to the deputy in operations.
Okay, and that deputy is final say?
Well, our district director always has final say. The deputy will make recommendation to our district director.
I'm just wondering, on that same issue, where's the common sense on some of these things? Because you're talking about the ideal time while the project is being constructed, the whole project, to include this and take care of a safety concern. It seems like this should be a common sense issue that everybody get around the table and say, yeah, now is the time to do this, even though it doesn't meet the traffic warrants.
Exactly. The timing on this was unfortunate. The project had gone out to bid. It was actually going out to construction when we started hearing these concerns. I think it was Aaron Brissetteri, maybe it was from you, Supervisor Forster, asking whether that project can be included, and I think the timing was right when it was going out to bid, or it had already been awarded, I think. At that point, that's where it's the train has left the station. You know, if it was within the AP, the affected potential area of impact for environmental, if there are no utility poles, if cost is not a concern, if right-of-way is not a concern, there's a potential, and I think our deputy, Diana, did look into that and responded, and that's why she had our design engineers prepare that layout to see if there was still a potential that it could be included. And that gets back to my earlier point. I think we're starting to have some better relationships and better partnering with local agencies, and I think over in the past we've been a little bit too protective. And I can tell you that we are recognizing the need to go out and better inform you of what we're doing, and we just did finish a safety team review committee just finished their work that we've been working for a year. I've been on the committee, and we came up with some recommendations for specific to our safety projects. You know, remember the Jackson Gate is an issue there, where we were recommending to the district director that we have our project managers inform local agencies of what we're doing much earlier in the process when we're developing our project study report. Not when we're going out to bid, but when we're doing our project study report, we know what we've recommended for funding. We want to disclose that information, hear your ideas, and then assess at that point whether there's going to be an impact on the cost and the scope and the schedule of the project. We didn't do that here, obviously, but I think that we do. Again, we recognize that we need to start doing that, and so I think that we need to engage more and have more of these discussions. Charles with the ACTC staff has already been working with our local assistance staff to review your local assistance projects to make sure they're on target. We're also talking with ACTC on our SHOP program. We have quarterly meetings right now on our SHOP projects.
The problem is, even if you have that review process much earlier and we come back and say, okay, same kind of situation, we want a turn lane there, is your your staff person's recommendation, based on the numbers he sees, not to put a turn lane in, they're going to override any local concerns.
Could be. So we could be in the same situation, granted. But at least we could have that dialogue earlier. We can come up with some other ideas, maybe a shared funding commitment. Maybe we could work together on preparing applications for grant funding. For instance, there's the Highway Safety Improvement Program that's we're expecting a call for that, those projects any day now, and the applications will be due at the end of June. And this, I think, would be a perfect candidate for that. We could work together. If we can't, what I'm saying is, if we can't fit this in here, if there's absolutely no way to fit this in here, if there's no extra money available to throw in from the contingency, or if we can't partner on it, I think we can work together on some other ideas. And one of them would be an HSIP application. And again, the conundrum here is that HSIP reviews accident data and collision history, but it allows some concessions for those projects that don't reach that threshold. That it's obviously some of the projects that reach the threshold will be plugged into our SHOP program. So there has to be an opportunity for other projects local agencies view as important and worthy of funding to be considered as eligible for grants from the HSIP program. I think this would be one of them. So I would offer to you that option. Let's go down the path of continuing discussions on the current project. I encourage you to write the letter, see if there's some way we can get this done with the current project still somehow. If we can't, let's try to get it done with something else, with HSIP or some other way. Just continue the discussions, try to find a way to do it.
All right, let me clarify two issues. There's design immunity is the one issue. The other issue, the mandatory design exception, Caltrans wants to stay away from that because, as I understand from talking to Charles, that requires you to go to the CTC to ask for a funding change?
That I'm not sure of. I don't know. Is that right, Charles? What I understand is that it requires the there's a mandatory design exception office in Caltrans headquarters in Sacramento that would be making that decision. I think whether... And then again, if there's no money in the contingency fund, then I guess maybe if it was something to pursue, the CTC would be requested for additional funds. Absent extra money out of the contingency. But as far as I understand, the design exception itself is something that has to be approved at headquarters. And currently our position is to not seek that from headquarters.
But not seek any mandatory design exception or just on this case?
Not for the poles.
Not for the poles.
So the preferred route would be to find some money. It's around $70,000 to do the pavement. Come up with a cost estimate on how much it would cost to get those poles out of the way.
Roger.
So you are looking at possibly going forward with the project, possibly. It's putting the left turn lane in.
Right now, I can tell you it's not recommended. It's not recommended right now. But as we're discussing it, we're looking into the contingency. Like I said, we're asking our resident engineer, is there extra money in the contingency right now to do it? I've asked them how much would it cost to move the poles. Once we have a good cost estimate, then we'd have to get together. Where are we going to come up with that money to do it?
That's the original.
We're talking two things here, though. I mean, you're saying on the one hand that the poles are the reason the project can't be done because they would require a design exception and Caltrans isn't willing to do that. And on the other hand, you're saying might not do it anyway because the traffic warrants don't rise to the threshold of requirement. So which trumps which? If we came up with money to move poles, could the project go forward, or would Caltrans still say hasn't met the thresholds for accidents, and therefore we won't do it?
And that's probably a discussion we had between you and our director. But the project as a standalone, I think Diana made that clear, is that it doesn't meet the threshold for state-only funding.
But the problem with that, though, is if Mr. Nguyen or whoever did the study, I mean, they're just looking at paper, and they're looking at figures off the paper showing them how many accidents have occurred at that intersection. If he'd actually got in a vehicle and driven that stretch a couple of times, and if he'd be the one to look in his rearview mirror and decide, you know, I'm getting off the road. I'm not going to take a chance somebody's going to run into me. But, I mean, we're going to have some testimony from a resident out there, but I mean, it is a very dangerous situation there.
At highway
speeds. Understood.
And especially making highway improvements there, you're going to possibly increase the speed even more on that highway.
Speaking about improvements, you know, I think it's a good idea that you have, or whoever brought it forth in Caltrans, as far as having earlier consultations on projects you're contemplating. Like when I saw Caltrans doing the work down there, it's in Supervisor Forrester's district, so I didn't have any idea what's going on. But I thought, oh, yeah, they're putting in a passing lane. What a great idea. Because they're going real wide, and it looked like they're going to build the passing lane. People said, oh, no, they're just widening the shoulders and straightening out a little bit. And I says, they're going that wide and not putting in a passing lane? And if you look at it, there's not a passing lane from down there, you know, basically at Clements all the way up almost darn near to Jackson. And there's a lot of trucks use that route. There's a lot of slow-moving vehicles. It'd be really nice to have a passing lane. Right there, you're starting to hit the hills there, and people are slowing down. And I think if we had those earlier meetings, that's something I would have lobbied for, just saying, hey, it's really be beneficial to the community, because that's probably the main route in and out of Amador County.
And I think Caltrans is on notice now, too. ACTC's traffic consultant, has looked at that intersection and indicated there is a definite safety concern there. I think that should be factored into whatever discussions are taking place right now at the Caltrans level. But we do appreciate you pushing hard on this and trying to get some activity on it.
We need to fix it. We completely empathize with the issue. Like I said, we're trying to get better. We haven't had that communication in the past. I think credit to your ACTC staff, they initiated and came to us and said they want to start talking about our shop projects. I think it was a couple of years ago. And last year, I think we finally did start these quarterly meetings so we can have that discussion. Unfortunately, it didn't happen early enough for this project. I don't think it's lost cause. I think we could still find a way to get this done, especially after seeing some of the preliminary work that's already been done. So I would encourage you to push, write the letter, see if we can follow up. Again, the ACTC, I think, is a great forum for us to try to deliberate here and to continue these discussions.
I would think, too, you'd probably also have some a lot cheaper costs, because traffic control when you're doing a major project like that is pretty expensive, and you have all the mobilization of all the equipment. So I would, unless the contractor's gouging, I think you should get, if you had it done concurrent with the construction that's being done now, I think it'd be a lot cheaper.
It does make sense. I agree.
I appreciate you coming forward and addressing our concerns. And
I'd just like to say I appreciate your recognition of the need for that earlier communication. John, you've been in a number of ACTC meetings where you've heard me rail on about the costs that Caltrans is willing to expend on projects, you know, to achieve community consensus, hundreds of thousands of dollars to get advance approval from the community about a Caltrans project, and on something like this where the community could have valuable input for a safety-needed project, we don't have that communication. So I appreciate you recognizing that and being willing to go forward with the suggestion that be included in those safety projects. Thank you.
Could you keep us in the loop, and Charles is our primary traffic or primary road construction and design person in the county with ACTC, so if you could keep us all in the loop, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. Will do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to take public comment at this time on this issue. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Frank.
Frank Costa. I live in Iowa. I live on Jackson Valley Road.
Hold that mic right in front of you, Frank. Thank you.
Frank Costa. I live in Ione on the Jackson Valley Road. The one thing I just heard that really is unfortunate is going to be the fact that if we do have an accident there, to get these numbers up where it warrants a road, we have to kill somebody. That's bad. I can tell you right now, I've been driving that road for 45 years. I have stopped hundreds and hundreds of times here, just like Mr. Forrester related, heading west. Traffic east is heavy. You've got three. I've been there when there's two or three cars ahead of me that have stopped. I'm the third in line waiting to go. You look behind you. There's four and five coming. Somebody in front decides they don't want to sit there. They pull out to the right in that gravel spot there to pass the car that's in front. So they continue west. The one behind you five cars, six cars back, they're all coming right behind you. I mean, there's been gravel thrown there. There's just everything there. Also, you have three school buses that travel that road three times a day, going to and from Comanche, 84-passenger school buses that just have a heck of a time there. Stopping, getting back on the road, taking a left-hand turn there, not to count the number of parents that are traveling from Comanche with kids in the car, in the winter, fog, everything. It's terrible there. The other thing, from Jackson to the Amador County line is where this new construction project has entailed. Every left-hand turn made off of 88 into Walmart, Kmart, even a little bread store, the cemetery, Upper Jackson Valley Road, Lower Jackson Valley Road, all have left-turn pockets. The only place that doesn't have a left-turn pocket is Martin Lane. And it has the most left-hand turn traffic off of 88, other than Walmart and Kmart, of any intersection on that highway. And yet, we don't have a turn pocket there. It's just, it's unbelievable that that's happening like that. The other thing on that is that the, I had it in here. Oh, again, the school buses. The school board is also, I went to the school board, they also, I'm sure that they've related to you people already, that they were concerned about that. The school bus drivers are just, they pull their hair at that intersection every day. They have something to say about it almost every day. Then, not to count now, summertime, the buses aren't running, basically, the vacation truck. But you still have a major traffic highway that comes out of Nevada, hay trucks, all these big trucks are coming out of there. These guys can't stop. You have fog. You get down in the valley in the morning, you could be clear up here in Jackson most of the time. You get down there in the mornings, you can't see 100 feet in front of you. And you're sitting there trying to make a left-hand turn, you're slowing down, and all of a sudden you see a car coming, heading east, you hit the brakes. That behind you, you can look in the rearview mirror and you're just wondering if you're going to hit, and you can actually see cars squiggling in behind you. It's a terrible intersection. We do need a turn pocket. There's no doubt about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Points, Frank.
Any other public comments? All right. Hearing none, I need board action to authorize a letter with the chairman's signature going out to Caltrans District 10 on this issue.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
I'll second that, and hopefully it captures everything that was said here today. Frank just made some great points that haven't been made before with the school bus issues. That is just a dangerous spot, and it's and the fact that everything else along that stretch has got left-hand turn lanes now, it's probably been paid for by Walmart and Kmart and so forth when they went in those places in some instances, but some of the other ones aren't business-driven. The intersection up the road at Ione, what is it, 104 and Jackson Valley, you know, that was an improvement project done not too long ago, and that got a turn section or a turn lane at it. So apparently, like you said, the travesty is that somebody's got to die before it raises to the level of attention, and that should not be the qualifier.
I think I indicated already about 2 weeks ago I was making that turn on Martin Lane from 88 and you know, when you have so much traffic going eastbound that you can't turn, but then you see a line of about 8-9 vehicles coming behind you, I quickly decided I'm not going to be the martyr on this thing. So
get off the
road and get out of the way.
You're not going to sacrifice for it?
not that far. But it is, that's the only reason that so many more accidents haven't happened there is people take the actions to avoid getting into a mess there. So with that, we have a motion by Supervisor Novelli, second by Supervisor Plaz, to approve sending a letter with chairman's signature to Caltrans District 10. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries 401. On item 6 on our agenda, Senate Bill 132, discussion of possible action relative to approval of the chairman's signature on a letter of opposition regarding the subject legislation that would establish the mountain lion to be a specially protected mammal under the laws of the state and make it unlawful to take, injure, possess, transport, import, or sell any mountain lion or any part or product thereof. I place this on the agenda. I don't expect a lot of discussion, but this legislation would make the mountain lion even more protected than it was by the California Wildlife Protection Act of 1990 that we, the voters of California, decided in their wisdom to
to pass. This would make it pretty much so no mountain lion could be taken by any lethal means. It would have to be by non-lethal, unless you see that there's imminent threat to livestock, primarily sheep, but sheep, goats, cattle are the ones affected by this. It is a little distressing that this restriction would go on, even though Mike Boitano, our ag commissioner, who wanted this to be on the agenda, said that there is a perceived exclusion of some areas, like rural counties. If you read the bill, there is no inclusion written, no exclusion written into it. So this is going to be adopted and apply statewide. Fish and Game, as I read this legislation, would have to utilize the non-lethal techniques to try and take these mountain lions that are causing problems out in the public. And we have our share of them in our county that have caused problems. I know just Sunday I was talking to a gentleman who said that he was going hunting for turkeys on a piece of property, and the owner of the property indicated, be careful because there's a deer up in a tree. So mountain lions are decimating our deer population as well. In Ione, there's been a significant sightings of mountain lions near the golf course, on the golf course. So the problem is, even with the methods we have of taking them now, it's just not enough to reduce the population so they don't infringe on each other's territory. A mountain lion, as I understand it, will roam a 200-mile territory, 200-square-mile territory. So they're, without the ability to take them, they're going to overlap, and the weakest and the oldest are going to be the ones that are out there scavenging for other means of survival.
You know, I think one thing, I'd like to make a little clarification, Chairman. The way this is written, I don't see any provisions in there for the takings of mountain lions when they're harming or possibly going to be harming livestock. The only provisions I see in this bill as the way it's going to be amended would be if there's an immediate, or it talks about
imminent threat.
Well, no.
The survival of certain sheep species.
No, it would require non-lethal procedures. Using or removing or taking any mountain lion perceived to be an imminent threat to public health or safety. The only way you could go beyond that is when the mountain lion can reasonably be expected to cause immediate death or physical harm. So that means you have to use non-lethal procedures, I guess, unless that mountain lion has his claws stuck in your jugular vein, then I guess you could maybe knife him or shoot him or whatever. I think this is just an asinine piece of legislation. Part of the problem I see is coming right out of the Bay Area, and I don't think they have very many mountain lion problems down in Palo Alto or Menlo Park or South San Francisco. And I think it's wrong on their part, and I'd be happy to tell them their face. And what they're doing is they're putting an unconscionable burden and threat on people in rural areas in the interest of saving their mountain lion, which they have probably never seen. There was a thing in the news a while back where there's some gentleman was hiking on a nature trail, I want to say around Auburn or Colfax. And to quote what I saw in the news, this gentleman said, he saw a mountain lion and thought, wow, that was really neat and wonderful, which is kind of the reaction. That's great and wonderful. And it was getting around dusk, and this mountain lion started to follow this gentleman. And he says he went from being, thought it was kind of a neat, great thing, to kind of was kind of getting scary. And he started throwing rocks at the mountain lion and hollering and yelling, and the mountain lion, I guess, got closer and closer and closer and came up within 20 feet of him. And so it turned dark, and he had a little small flash so I could see its eyes. So I guess him and the mountain lion were going around in circles, and he called his wife, and either his wife or himself had called 911, and they sent a helicopter, and it showed up and then scared the mountain lion away. So this person, I guess you could say, took care of his bodily facilities and went home very scared. And the next day, a Fish and Game employee, I believe it's Fish and Game, went out to post signs, dangerous mountain lion in the area. And he looks up and hears this mountain lion stalking him. So he shot the mountain lion. Now, the point I'm making is, you know, out in the rural areas, you know, we have livestock that we're trying to make a living. Some of these ranchers are, and you have livestock you're trying to protect, and they're going to make it to where it's basically impossible to take a mountain lion. And I think it's wrong. There's a lot of mountain lions out there, and you have to wait till you're being physically attacked before you can defend yourself. You got a mountain lion that's always hanging around somewhere, you know, watching school kids. Do you want to wait till it's attacking the kids before you can dispatch a mountain lion? I don't. And it's just very upsetting to see the way they're putting forth legislation that really has no effect on them, but has a major effect on the rural areas.
The reason I made that statement is that's what Mike Boitano indicated, is they're trying to couch this bill that it won't stop ordinary people out there from taking mountain lions.
Doesn't say that.
I know. That's the way they're trying to couch it, though, and that's what he indicated to me, that they're trying to get support for it by saying that it's going to be just like it was before, but if you really read the bill, it's not going to be like it was, like it is today if this bill passes, because you'll only be able to use those non-lethal procedures. What this is forcing, unfortunately, people back into is the shoot, shovel, and shut up scenario. And I don't think you want to create criminals out of people by passing bad law. The other thing, Section 2, the last provision here, the legislature finds and declares that the provisions of this act are consistent with and further the purposes of the California Wildlife Protection Act of 1990. I don't believe that to be the case, and I think our legislators should fight it based on that it's taking away a big right that people have to take mountain lions if they are being a pest to the livestock.
Or even an imminent threat. They're saying if you have an imminent threat, you can't even do anything.
That's right.
It has to be basically where you're looking at immediate death or physical harm. An imminent threat, in my book, is something that where you should have a right to be able to defend yourself or your livestock. And also it talks about they can take them when it's perceived by the department to be an imminent threat to the survival of certain sheep. I think what I'm talking about there is fish and game can take a mountain lion if it's probably being predatory towards some of your endangered species threatening endangered species like bighorn sheep or something like that. They're not talking about livestock.
You had some comments on the bears, too.
A couple of points I wanted to make. First off, I concur with everything that's been said here today. And secondly, I've had personal experience with this whole policy of trap and relocate. Our family ran a resort, as you well know, up in the mountains for years, and that's been the policy of Fish and Game with regards to problem bears in campgrounds for years was trap and release. And predominantly, they were trapping bears that became problem bears in Yosemite and releasing them up on what we all know is Squaw Ridge and the Emigrant Trail up there. And the trouble is, once that wild animal has changed its behavior patterns through recognition that tipping over garbage cans and getting into dumpsters is a whole lot easier than going out and foraging for food like they had to in the past, or in the case of a mountain lion, when feeding on a species such as humans that would be much easier to catch in the wild than running down a deer, when those wild animals change their behavior patterns, they don't revert back once they've been relocated to someplace else. They find the next nearest campground to go to. And we had countless bears tagged, ear-tagged, and so forth, relocated from Yosemite that came into the Silver Lake area and became the same kind of problem there that they were in Yosemite. And it got to the point where the Fish and Game would bring a trap up. We'd catch the bear, and then they didn't have staffing or time to come up and deal with the bear, and they just tell us, deal with it. And
one thing
we dealt with it. But, I mean, that was Fish and Game's. Their stated policy was if a bear is bothering the campground, we close the campground. And they heard my opinion on that suggestion rather forcefully. And subsequently, they just didn't bother with it. They just told us to deal with it on our own, and that, That's the trouble. Relocation of a wild animal will not change the new behavior pattern that that animal has developed. And so this whole notion of we're going to rehabilitate the mountain lion. California has the highest population of mountain lions of any state in the country, the highest, and we're the only state that doesn't allow hunting of them. And hypocrisies of all hypocrisies, this bill and the bill from 1990 says you cannot possess or import or anything else, any part or whatever of a mountain lion. So basically it says you can't legally go to Nevada or Idaho or any other place, buy a tag, legally hunt a mountain lion, pay to have that mountain lion taxidermy mounted, and have it in your home. Because even though you did everything legally and paid for it all along the way in another state where it's legally in, they're saying you can't bring that across the border and display it in your home. Yet you go over here to our sheriff's office or you go down to the fish and game office at Lake Natoma, and guess what's on display in their offices? A stuffed mountain lion.
That's so different, John.
Hypocrisy of all hypocrisy, especially for fish and game to have one in their offices at Lake Natoma.
So what they're encouraging people to do is have a second home or a primary home in Texas or someplace like that.
You know, one thing I'd like to make a clarification, or just Supervisor Plass talked about trapping bears and traps. I think bears, from what I've heard and seen, are pretty easy to trap in a live trap.
Oh, I would think so.
A mountain lion is now a mountain lion is a total different story. They're one of the cagiest darn animals out there, and I've talked to a number of people who've tried catching them live, and it don't happen. I mean, they're wary beyond wary. So
well, and they have no innate fear of mankind anymore, because it's been 23 years now since this Protection Act of 1990 that they've actually been hunted. I mean, they are at the top of the food chain, and they have no innate fear of man, because generationally, there's no mountain lions left that have been hunted by a superior predator.
And there's an awful lot of near misses you don't hear about. And like John was talking about the three S's, I think there's a lot of that goes on. I can't remember who I was talking to, but there's some young kids out down near Ione. And they had a mountain lion, I guess they're pretty near the house, and this thing came at them pretty good. And I guess supposedly the young girl knocked some hair out of it with a stick, we'll say.
Slingshot, huh?
A slingshot, yeah. And they never saw a lion again. This is, you know, basically the kids, they felt they're under attack.
Well, Supervisor Novelli's had
you don't hear about those.
Supervisor.
Thank you. I oppose this bill because of, for many reasons, and if you read it and read it as it's written here, there's a lot of as defined, and when you look up as defined under the required non-lethal procedures, I have some questions in regards to that. And also, too, when you look up that the wildlife incident report for the Fish and Game Commission, when any direct action is to be taken on a mountain lion, you know, there we have government spending time in regards to doing all this paperwork when we all know what has to be done in regards to this. So I think this bill is, there's a lot of loopholes in this, and I concur with everything that was said here today.
Let's open it up to public comment now. Is there any public comment? Hearing none, I did speak to Assemblyman Bigelow about this and encourage him to oppose it. We'll include him on notice from our letter if we pass it. But I also asked him to speak to one of the co-authors who he knows very well, Assemblyman Richard Gordon from the Bay Area, and try to talk some common sense into him. But with that, is there any other comments? Can I have a motion, gentlemen?
Sure, I'd make a motion that we send a letter to Senator O'Hale, also to some members Gordon and Mullen, and opposing their proposed legislation. Also, that we should send a letter to our elected representatives in California.
I'd also ask for RCRC and CSAC to be noticed on this.
Sure, and maybe even to Governor too. It wouldn't hurt. I mean, it's probably a little bit early, but just like for send a letter. Send it out to all of them.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Ornato, second by Supervisor Novelli to send a letter in opposition to this legislation. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries 401. Item 7 on the agenda, Assembly Bill 134, discussion possible action on the chairman's signature for a letter of support relative to the subject legislation, which would exempt from the Public Records Act the names and home addresses of California citizens who possess a California concealed weapons permit. And anybody else want to lead on this one?
Sure. I asked to have this put on our agenda. Our Sheriff Ryan had written an excellent letter to Mr. Dan Logue, supporting the legislation being put forth by Logue, which would exempt from the Public Records Act the names and home addresses of citizens who possess a California concealed weapons permit. And I can understand the Freedom of Information Act. I think it's a great thing. But I don't see any reason why they should know individually who has a concealed weapons permit. The whole idea of having a concealed weapons permit is that it's concealed. And I don't think it would do the public any benefit to know, you know, who has one and where they live. If anything, it might be a threat to those people, because if you get a criminal that's real savvy, they might go and say, look at the county's records, say who has guns, and go and possibly steal some of their guns. So I would like to support our sheriff's position and also also our citizens, and send that letter.
You know, who has guns and who doesn't have guns, and target the households that
that's true,
on
yeah.
The list. I mean,
conversely, yeah, you're right.
The protection goes both ways on this one.
All right. Any other comments from the board? Any public comment? Board members' action?
Move. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd make a motion that we send a letter to the Honorable Dan Logue, Assemblyman, supporting his legislation.
And send the same notifications to our legislators, RCRC.
Sure. The whole group.
For a second?
Second.
And that'd be a support for Senate Bill 132.
But, motion by Supervisor Ornato, second by Supervisor Plowse.
134.
Yeah, we have a conflict here, so I was going to clarify it. It should be Senate Bill 134.
Assembly Bill 134? AB.
Right. Assembly Bill 134.
Okay. Just with the record reflect.
AB 134, correct?
Correct.
Assembly Bill. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Right, item 8 on the agenda, Senate Bill 296, and asking for discussion possible action relative to approval of chairman's signature on a letter of support for the subject legislation, which would increase local assistance funding for county veteran services officers. And with that, Mr. Novelli, you want to lead off on this?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I asked our veteran service officer, Terry Sanders, to come up and briefly explain this. This is in regards to subvention funds coming forward to our veteran service officers in all the counties of the state of California. So Terry Sanders is here, and I believe, Terry, you got some handouts for us?
Yes, I do, Supervisor Novelli. Can I approach?
Yes, sir. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I'm Terry Sanders, Amador County Veteran Service Officer. Thank you for seeing me. And what I'm requesting is as you've already read, support for this county from the Board of Supervisors to increase the subvention funds to the state of California that is shared amongst the counties based on workload units. We're presently sharing $2.6 million. And this bill is to increase it to $11 million.
$11 million now?
That's what I understand, yes, sir. And I know on here it says $9 million, so honestly I'm a little confused myself. However, that's what I've been led to believe, it's $11 million.
Okay. I think that's what you told me when we talked about it, wasn't
it? Right, and that email that I had forwarded to you had that information on it. But the big picture of this is that the bigger the pie of subvention funds, the bigger the amount of money that comes to the county into the general fund.
Well, it's currently the subvention funds only cover about 20% of the cost of the VSO.
That's correct.
It would certainly be an improvement.
And by law, the subvention funds can pay up to 50% of my department's funding. And there's just not enough money that's coming from the state to reach that percentage.
So, I mean, the numbers on this are very confusing. San Bernardino's letter said one thing. The bill strikes $5 million and puts in $9 million, but your understanding is more like $11
million? Yes, and I totally agree. There's a lot of confusion on it. However, the point is still the same. They're trying to get it increased. And the package that I handed out is, do you know who Pete Conate is? He is the California Association of Veteran Service Officers speaker lobbyist that goes to Sacramento and talks about Veterans Affairs and all that kind of stuff and talks to the senators up in Sacramento. He is actually paid by the Association of County Veteran Service Officers. So that first letter is telling us being the county veteran service officers, what's going on. And that's the first page. And what I find very interesting is that there has not been an increase in the subvention funding since 1997.
And wouldn't you say that California has a large amount of veterans?
Yes, if you read further down into this letter that he puts out, we have the highest amount of veterans throughout the United States.
And wouldn't you say that our little Amador County has a large amount of veterans for our population?
We have well over 5,000 veterans in our population, and the second page is from the California State Association of Counties. And then if you go on, and there's just a letter here from veterans. And then the last page is a letter that I ginned up, you know, specific to this county. Whether or not you guys decide on this is the format and the verbiage you want on, of course, is your decision. But I took the liberties to gin up the letter already.
Yeah, and the only thing I would like to ensure before we send this letter, it does say increase of $5 million statewide. We'll use that figure unless you can verify that there is another amount that's more appropriate.
Yes,
there's from that, Mr. It looks like Vietnam Veterans of California, they're talking about
$11 million.
That SB 296 authorized $7.4 million for a total of $11 million.
So there's a lot of different numbers being thrown around. I mean, I concur, and I'm just the lowest guy on this totem pole that gets this information, trying to make sense of it.
Mr. Sanders, can I ask what is the distribution formula currently used by the state, and does this bill anticipate that the same formula will be used to distribute whatever the state considers its total out to the counties?
Okay, I can break that down for you, but I'll do the best I can for understanding. Is that, first off, I'll answer the latter question. The answer is it will not change how they break down the money. But they break down the money by, through the calendar year, all of veteran service reps do claims. And each one of those claims has a different workload unit value. So then the state adds up all of those workload unit values throughout the state and divide that pot of money by that number.
Okay.
All right? And so then they go, each workload unit is worth that much money. And so if my county does 100 claims or 100 workload units, then I get that number times 100. So if that pot of money is bigger, everything becomes bigger. But by law, they cannot supply more than 50% of that office's or department's budget. And it also comes in other forms. It's not only workload units. It comes in license plate fees. It comes in Medi-Cal avoidance fees. It also comes in conferences and meetings that I'm required to go to three times a year. So there's a lot of different things that the CDVA pays out.
And is the number that we have for the current allocation, the $2.6 million, is that currently accurate?
Yes, sir. That's current, and that hasn't changed since 1995.
Okay. So the state currently distributes $2.6 million, and we don't know whether this bill goes from up to five.
Well, we're not. Yeah. therein is the confusion on my part and your part. You read all these different letters, and they all say something a little different. But the point still is the same. It's to get an increase, thereby paying the general fund more money and making Mr. Eiley's job a little easier.
Well, and I think, Mr. Chairman, if we were to present a letter, we could just, being that, you know, we don't know the exact figure right now, we could just say that we would...
just in support of this bill.
Support the bill in regards to any increase in regards to... funds being allowed to be increased to come to all the veteran service officers in the state of California.
Unless Mr. Sanders can clarify that amount, because we have our statewide association of counties assuming it's going to be five. San Bernardino said five, but the Vietnam Veterans letter indicates it's a little bit more than that.
Right, yes, sir.
And there's also, it looks like what the confusion may come in, there's money that's being allocated to... looks like the American Legion, to congressionally chartered organizations such as the American Legion, and the Veterans of Foreign Wars, so that might be where some of the discrepancies are coming in.
Okay.
Could be, yeah.
Any further questions?
Public comment?
Thank you, Terry.
Okay, thank you.
Any public comment? None. Board action?
Mr. Chairman, I make a recommendation that we write a letter in regards to Senate Bill 296 to support this equation for an increase of funds to the state of California for all the veteran service officers in the state of California.
That'd be your motion.
Yes, sir.
Second.
Moved by Supervisor Novelli, second by Supervisor Plas to send a letter in support of this legislation. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries 401. Item 9, Assembly Bill 350, discussion of possible action relative to the chairman's signature on a letter of support for the subject legislation which expands the diameter of a tree stump exempted from the forest fire prevention exemption under the timber harvest plan. And Supervisor Onetto, you want to lead on this one?
Sure. I think it's not a bad idea. I don't know if it'll really make that much difference because... if you look at the forest fire prevention exemption, it's in the California Forest Practice Rules, and I got one little book that's here. It's under 4584. That's the chapter it's under. There's still some conditions in there that make it very onerous to try to get the actual work done. One thing they want within 45 days, it seems reasonable unless you've done logging. They want all the brush to be chipped, burned, or otherwise removed from all areas of timber operations. The problem is, if you're cutting green trees for fire safety, you're not supposed to burn green material in California. So that means, and it takes, you know, quite a while to dry out, so really, basically you're stuck with chipping it. And that's super expensive. Chipping or hauling it off. I could see what they should do. They should change where you should have that material removed, basically those conditions, but done in a year. So you can let it dry out for 1 year, and then you could pile that stuff and burn it. The idea of making it do a little bit bigger diameter trees is probably a good thing, because as it stands right now, you can't cut a tree that's less than 18 inches at stump diameter, and that's measured from like 6 or 8 inches above ground, up to 24 inches under certain conditions. So if you translate that into how big a tree you're talking at diameter breast height, you're really talking about a 14-inch tree generally, and in specified conditions, maybe a 20-inch tree. Well, that's, in order to do some of that work, unless you're absolutely rich, you want to be able to cut some bigger trees to help pay for the cost of what you're doing as far as thinning and making it more fire safe. And what this bill would do would allow people to take bigger trees so they could get some monetary income to pay for the work they're doing. So I think it's probably a pretty good bill overall. I'd like to see it go better. It should allow, you know, maybe a longer time frame to clean up the slash. I think that'd be very helpful. And something else they have in there, they want, CDF is always pushing maximum sustained production on timberland. And one problem with that, when you have maximum sustained production fully stocked, is you're more fire prone. It's saying, you know, you got to have all kinds of trees out in that forest land. Well, if you want to make it more fire safe, you don't want to necessarily always have maximum sustained production, because it's almost creating a fire problem. But they're saying you got to have a lot of trees on that per acre. So I guess we probably can't address that this time. It's probably above and beyond my pay scale. But as far as the legislation, I think it's probably pretty good legislation. It would allow them to do more work, I think, on smaller parcels of land.
And this is co-sponsored across the aisles here. Assemblyman Frank Bigelow, Republican. Assemblyman Bob Warkowski out of Fremont, a Democrat. So hopefully there's support on both sides of the aisle for this. As they said in their position paper, the problem is there's just not enough harvesting going on right now and thinning because it's not economically feasible based on the diameter size that, of the 18 to 24 in special cases. So the way I look at it, anything that might help is better than where we're at right now. So let's see if we can get this one passed first. But the other thing they indicated where this should get a lot of support is you're looking at our legislature that's worried about greenhouse gas emissions, and what they estimate from this is 142 million, it must be 142 million tons that's of emissions that's being created. So if this helps at all with our
Forest fires.
Our greenhouse gas problems through because of those forest fires and the emissions off those fires, then we should be supporting this.
I would think it'd be a good thing, but also if we can maybe include in our letter something they may want to look at is a treatment of the slash, because the way they have it now, it must be chipped or burned or hauled off. It's I wouldn't call it quite punitive, but almost. I've done logging for a lot of years, and when you put that requirement in there, all of a sudden, something that might be feasible if you could go in there and lop and scatter it, and then come back in and burn it maybe 6 months or a year later, it's pretty doable. But when you have to either chip it, burn it, or haul it off, and somebody comes and says, hey, I'll give you the trees to take them out, I'd say, you know what, forget it. I'm not going to do it. It's not, unless you can come back.
And that's the problem. I mean, I just want to comment. That's the problem with so much of this law, not this law, but the laws that have been passed, is that they just run so contrary to economic feasibility. They study the greenhouse gas emissions. They study the watershed. They study all these types of things that they're going to save. And in saving the trees by limiting the size that anybody can take to, you know, 18 inches in diameter, they've caused the forests to become overgrown. They've caused the wildfire danger to go up exponentially. And instead of getting the thinning operations done, what they since this law was passed that was supposed to help more thinning occur, they've gone from thinning 25,000 acres down to 5,000 acres. For that very reason, it is not economically feasible for anybody to go out and just perform thinning operations. There's not enough value to the chips. There's not enough value to the small diameter lumber that can be harvested. So nobody does it. And then we have groups, and we've got one here locally, and I'll mention them by name, not to be scared here, the Amador Calaveras Consensus Group runs out and brags that they got how many millions of dollars of federal-funded grants to go out and do this work. So you've taken an enterprise that was self-sustaining and generated significant incomes for the Amador County and every other county that got 25% of every dollar of value that was harvested off federal lands, in this case, not private. But it was a self-sustaining industry that generated jobs and generated significant incomes for our roads and schools. And you've converted it to an industry that is dependent on federal funding through grants to get the work done. And, you know, somewhere along the line, and I think it's happening now, Professor Economics is coming home to play, and he's saying you're not going to get it done if there's no economic incentive to do it. It just becomes a cost that's expected to be borne by the federal government and eventually the taxpayer. Sorry, I'm on my stump, but it amazes me.
Okay, at this time we'll take public comment. Is there any public comment on this? Hearing none. Board members, your action.
I'd like to make one more comment, if I could, on discussion. Number, what they've also done with all the regulations, they made it very hard for people to manage your forest. The family has 40 acres up by Ham Station. And one time we said, you know, we'd like to go up there and basically clean it up a little bit and just remove some real sick and problem trees. So we filed a 10% dead and dying exemption because that's something you could do pretty realistically. It's time-wise, it's pretty quick, and expense is rather low. And we went up there, and we did a real nice job and took out some sick, lame, lazy trees and kind of cleaned the place up. And CDF had a cow. Basically, almost threatened all, just about one to site us. I think they kind of couldn't because of if there had been any green trees, and they dried out and were brown. But, well, you cut green trees. I says, well, they were sick and dead and dying. And they were. Well, we think they were green. Boy, they were mad. And I said, part of the problem is we'd like to clean the place up. And I says, there's no mechanism to do it without going and filing a harvest plan. And I said, if you file a harvest plan, it's real expensive. And then you got to rather than cutting a few trees and clean your place up, I say, now I've filed the harvest plan, cost $5,000 or $10,000. So you got to cut a bunch of trees. And I said, we don't want to cut a bunch of trees. We like our forest. He said, don't matter. That's how you got to do it. So you see, governments made it some of their legislation, they made it very hard for people to maintain their forest.
Right.
So this legislation might help.
Well, might help a little. The problem, too, is last year they passed more legislation on timber harvest plans that make it more difficult for people to go out and harvest trees. So, but well, this might help.
And the public is paying another 1% tax on any board they buy at Lowe's now.
So how about some action on this?
Yep, I'll make a motion. I make a motion that we send a letter of support for Assembly Bill AB 350, and I guess we should send it to all the state legislators and like RCRC, CSAC, and governor and the whole bunch.
And if you would, I'd like to second it, but I'd like to include that the your comments about the other factors that aren't addressed in this bill that maybe.
Thank you, Supervisor Plaz. Yes, I would make that part of my motion. That also we talk about as far as the method of treating the slash that's left over, if there could be a longer timeline, basically put in that bill also. And as far as just wanting all standards for meeting stocking, that's something they may want to address too, especially the treatment of the slash.
We can put it in there. I would ask that we not go too far with it just because we want to stay on point on supporting this bill, and sometimes if you ask for too much, it just dilutes the main
and
position
that's true.
Of the bill.
All that's right, pretty important.
Might make a better bill, though.
It might, but it might make it more difficult to get passed, too. I think they try to take bites at this and get down what they think is conceivable. Moved by Supervisor Ornetto, second by Supervisor Plaz to support Assembly Bill 350 and with additional language. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries 401. We'll go to item 9B. This is our addenda, one of our addenda, Amateur Council of Tourism, discussion relative to the proposed 2013 state fair booth model and funding request for facilitation of construction of the same. Ms. Funk, good morning.
Good morning, Maureen Funk, Executive Director of Amateur Council Tourism. I brought you a model of our proposed exhibit. I'll bring it up to you. First, I want to thank you for the opportunity to do this again. This will be our fifth year. Amateur Council Tourism is... It doesn't spin because the banner touches it, I know. But the little guy moves up and down next to the Ferris wheel. We decided as an organization we'd like to give a nod to the 75th anniversary of the Amador County Fair as our county exhibit at State Fair. The Ferris wheel is meant to represent that. On the sheet will be products of Amador County as it goes around. It will have a steampunk kind of vibe, which is that Victorian sci-fi kind of thing like the Sherlock Holmes movies have with the cogs and the wheels and all that sort of thing, the brass. And our steam-powered sawmill plays very beautifully into that motif. And I'm hoping to work with Bill Braun and the Sawmill Society to get maybe a little smaller steam-powered motor to put it on display in the booth. I've contacted Jim Geedy from KVGC for his Tales of the Fair done by Cedric Clute. We will have those segments playing in the booth on a loop so that people can enjoy the story of our fair. And also we'll have QR codes for those who don't want to stand there and listen. They can just snap the QR code and get a little bit of the different stories of the fair and listen to it on their phone going around the booth. So we're going to have something that accesses for the younger generation, gets them to interact with their smartphones and the QR codes. We'll have something for those of us who just as soon stand around and listen to a story being told. And of course, we'll still have a nod to the recreation in the county, along with our mining history and our agricultural tourism and agriculture, the wineries and so forth. Those two banners that are along the one side, it's required to have a map of Amador County required to have a map of the county in every booth. So one of the banners would have the map with our various points of interest. And then the other one, we're talking about having a calendar of events. And there's lots of places to display brochures and so forth for the various destinations and businesses here in Amador County. Any questions, comments, advice?
Where it says steam power on there?
Right.
What, is there going to be anything there or just a banner?
No, there'll be a little display. We're going to build a display around what I can possibly wrangle from the Sawmill Association. I have not contacted them yet directly, but Bill Braun has worked with me wonderfully over the past several years. Our thought was to have an actual steam engine on display, not necessarily operating, but just a display, and then have, I like Huell Hauser's video that he did, have that playing, or have photos showing, demonstrating what it'll be. But that there will be a specific nod to that portion of the fair.
Might smoke people out if it was operating.
Yeah, could be fun.
It's steam, it's not smoke.
Yeah. Hey, what's the proposed cost?
I've been running this thing for about $10,500 for 3 years running. Our rate of expense.
That's your history, the 3 years of doing this?
Yeah.
I might say that you've been doing a great job. I've been down at the State Fair manning those booths and receiving the ribbons, and you'd be surprised how many people come up and ask questions about Amador County. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a privilege to do it. I really enjoy it.
Okay. Why don't you have a seat? I'm going to ask for public comment at this time. Morning.
Good morning. My name is Diane Dennett. The State Fair booth is a wonderful way to help bring tourism to Amador County, and the exposure to the thousands of visitors at the State Fair, you don't get a better bang for your buck. It is definitely something worth doing that represents the county well. I know that there are several builders, though, within the county that for the last few years have not. Last year I was contacted, but the others have not been contacted, and I'm just saying in future years, you know, we talk about bringing money to the county, but we also should think about keeping money within the county. So further in advance in the year, it would be nice if something went out asking for bids and other ideas from within the county itself, too. I think this is a great way to spend the money. I think it is something that the county should do. I know I'm involved with some other counties that are doing it. So I just think that next year we might want to think about letting, I know Doug Westcott's built before. I know that John Carollo's built before, and I know I've built for other counties. So just something to keep in mind, but I think this is a great way to bring tourism to our county. And I love the theme that they're doing this year. I know if I would have proposed something, it would have been with the county fair too, because it is our 75th year. So good job, Maureen. I love the way it looks. Next year, let's see if we can try to keep some money in the county, though, when we look at the builders.
Question for you. Are you building any exhibits for counties this year?
Yes. I'm building Nevada County again this year, and I may have two others.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Maureen, you might want to keep that in mind for the future, that there are people in the county, so if we got out with notice early enough that they could come in with ideas or possibly be in the running to construct the fair booth. Maureen, could you come back up? As far as funding for the state fair booth, Chuck, we have, what, $5,000 budgeted?
That's correct, $5,000 for the fair booth.
So beyond that $5,000, you and ACT are going to be raising the remainder?
I have an individual plan that I've not brought before my board of directors yet. My board of directors meets on Thursday, and I want to have some discussion about repeating what we did last year, which was develop a letter asking partners to work with us to put this booth together. So my hope is, yes, that we will take that same course of action this year.
So at this time, though, you're not asking for anything beyond that $5,000 allocation?
That's correct.
Okay.
As I recall, I mean, just to nail down what you just said, Maureen, when you talk about that course of action, could you be, because my recollection is the course of action last year was $1,000 from each of our discretionary funds.
I don't believe no. We raised I would have to review this to be certain, John, but last year didn't work for you guys to put in $5,000 apiece. Excuse me,
no,
Supervisor Class.
So,
what I did was my board of directors decided to, pardon me, Supervisor Forster, was to write a letter and go to each of the organizations, and we were able to raise it that way.
Hmm. Okay, maybe I'm remembering 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think it was voluntary last year, depending.
Correct.
On because some supervisors don't have a lot of money in their discretionary accounts. They use it for other things, and the amount has been significantly slashed, and this year is probably going to be slashed again. So.
Yeah, that's my memory as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen.
Okay.
Chuck, that's in our budget, so that's been voted on already
correct.
Long ago, so we don't need to take any action on that.
Other than to release the funds, direct me to release the funds, and I'll take care of it.
Okay, we do have the funding request for facilitation of construction on our agenda, so we can take that action today.
I would move that we authorize the CAO and County Auditor to release the budgeted funds for the 2013 California State Fair booth.
Second. Moved by Supervisor Plass, second by Supervisor Novelli. And Maureen, I think that on the 75th anniversary of our fair, it was a good selection to make the theme center around the Amador County Fair. With that, any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 All opposed? Motion carries 4-0-1. With that, the board's going to take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back to our 10:30 public hearing.